you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, if you've heard this one, stop me. No, I don't want you to do that. I've just heard a great line from someone, because as we get older, John, we start to repeat stories. There was a guy who said to someone I was talking to, he had the greatest line for that. He said, hey, if you've heard this one before, you're going to really like it a second time. Don't stop me. Yeah, I'm not going to not tell it because I like telling it. So it doesn't matter if you've heard it. But remember in school, you and I dating ourselves, how a bill becomes a law. Now, remember we used to get a slip
I'm just
of paper.
A bill. Yes. Remember that?
There was a song?
Only a bill. And I'm sitting here in a Capitol. You don't remember that?
No.
That was on... My kids watched it, Schoolhouse Rock.
Oh, Schoolhouse Rock. Okay. Well, I remember the paper that showed us, oh, it starts this way by a lonely little representative having a big idea, and then they share it, and then it's discussed, and then it's passed. And it doesn't tell us anything about lobbyists. It doesn't tell us about all the influence peddling. It doesn't tell us about any of that naughty stuff, right? And we all sat there, oh, this is so nice. What a system we have.
It's growing a great system.
Yeah, great system. Well,
if only it weren't for lobbying and everything else.
Well, probably one of the most recognizable parts of many people's experience in school. And amazingly, John, we did buy it. We bought it. Hook, line, and sinker, because everybody still talks about it. Well, I even hear congressmen sometimes when they're debating, well, we all looked at when we were in school how a bill became a law, but this is not the way. And the way you're contorting the process, and then the other side, we're not contorting the process. You are, blah, 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 blah. But let's be honest about it. The stuff that they left out was pretty dramatic and impactful.
Not to mention the little dingleberries that they add to just to get it through.
Oh, so you got a bill, and it's about X, and they tack on Y to get the votes that they need, and Y has nothing to do with X, and it adds an immeasurable amount of money to the entire package. Well, we also thought, John, I think, through how a bill becomes a law, that legislator A had a great idea and brought it to all the bill writing folks. Now, that's another piece of it that, though they're not, you know, anything we should worry about. But, you know, when a legislator does have an idea, they often don't know how to write it into law, and they don't know exactly how to make certain it conforms to other laws already on the books.
Right.
So they have to go to the office that writes those laws, and they say, here's my idea. You know, they put it down on a napkin, and they say, here, I got this from a constituent, or I came up with this in the middle of the night. I wrote it down, and here it is. Make it into a law. You know, so they do that, literally.
Right.
Okay. But there's a whole new thing going on out there, John. There's a whole new thing going on out there, and it's called model bills, or it's called copycat legislation, or it's called policy plagiarism, whatever you want to call it. But in other words, there are a lot of bills that get circulated all around America by various kinds of interest groups. And they mark them up, they write them up. So you come in as a freshman legislator, and you've gotten all this stuff from them. Like we all get email from everyone that we could copy, right? And all of a sudden, you're a genius, and you put 10 bills in the hopper that were written by who knows who for what effect, and they often are misnamed, mislabeled, so you've got these great, you know, bills that come in as if they want to help someone, and what they really want to do is reform torts so that this, you know, group cannot be sued by the public, you know, asbestos or whatever, and it's put forward by fill in the blank. So, John, this is going on to a fairly well around the country. And what is really interesting is that the Center for Public Integrity, a good group that is a nonprofit organization, got together with USA Today and the Arizona Republic, which is a big paper in Arizona, and they've been doing extensive reporting on this topic of model legislation. And we brought Liz White to our microphones, a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, and she walks us through how a bill really becomes a law.
This should be interesting.
In more cases than you might imagine. So this is a trend in America. And it's not all bad. I mean, you know, maybe it's coming from the Cancer Society or maybe from another organization. But is there real transparency? And do we really know who's writing this stuff?
I think the other side of it is are they actually, are any of these congressmen actually reading these bills, or do they have somebody else read them for and give them like a summary?
Or if, look, if they go to these organizations, there's one called ALEC that we talk about that does a lot of this. And if they say, well, they're usually in league with me. They're conservative or they're this or they're that. Why do I need to really understand it? If they give me a summary and tell me this is what it really does, even though it's got all the legalese, then I'll put it in. And oftentimes, yeah, I think they probably do have a hard time defending it once, you know, they're questioned about it if they haven't really made it their own.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Very interesting topic. Let's get to Liz White right now. And I think you're going to find this very illuminating today on America Trends.
With us on the line on America Trends is Liz White, a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. And they were involved in a 2-year investigation along with USA Today and the Arizona Republic. And it's about a thing called model bills. Now, we'll tell you what that means as we go along. But Liz, explain to us the Center for Public Integrity. Tell us a little bit about your organization.
Yeah, the Center for Public Integrity is a nonprofit newsroom, and we've been around for 30 years. We do long-term deep dive investigations, and we partner with other media outlets to publish those. So this case, we did a huge partnership with USA Today and the Arizona Republic for this series of stories. And we are donor-funded and cover all sorts of things, environment, money and politics, national security. You can find us online at publicintegrity.org.
Okay, great. So the concept of model bills, if people don't understand what that means, some call it policy plagiarism, and it's gotten other terms, copycat legislation. But describe it to us, what you were looking at and why it got your attention.
Model legislation is kind of the inside baseball term for it, but we've been calling it copycat legislation or something. I think people, when they hear model legislation, think, oh, it must be good legislation, which there's some pieces of it that pretty much everyone's in favor of, or things that are just trying to simplify laws that vary between states, that kind of thing. But really, it represents a whole range of special interests, such as hyper-partisan conservative groups or liberal groups, or just, you know, specific unions or things like that, who decide that they would like a policy changed in multiple states and end up writing a piece of legislation that they then tweak or adapt for each state, but is essentially the same, and they're shopping it around to multiple jurisdictions to try to get lawmakers to get on board. And the thing that's interesting about it and why we decided to kind of pursue it is a lot of times even the lawmakers themselves don't know that it's model legislation. They don't know that it's written by a special interest. They just see that someone has already done the legwork there, and that makes things a little bit easier. So there's a lot of model legislation that's been passed in the states, and I think people would be rather shocked to learn that their lawmakers don't necessarily write the laws. They might get them handed to them from lobbyists.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you, Liz. I mean, do you have the idea that most people think that I'm a local legislator, I'm in touch, I got elected, and I just have all these incredible ideas, and I just want to turn them into legislation? Or do they imagine that even within their own states, aside from stuff that comes from outside of their state, that they've got lobbyists in their ear, or they've got legislative aides who really come up with all these ideas? I mean, at the beginning, what did you think the organic process for this was, or what do you think most people think it is?
Well, there's not really poll data on what people think is actually going on in politics, but I always think of the classic Schoolhouse Rock
bill
song.
Became a law.
Yeah, where, you know, the people get together and they say there ought to be a stop sign, and the lawmaker writes it up and it, you know, passes through Congress. Whereas really that this process is not as organic as that at all. You know, this could be a vast effort in order to shore up someone's bottom line and shore up an industry's bottom line, and then a lobbying campaign proceeds with this model legislation in their pocket.
And there are so many other nuances that we will get into. But these copycat bills amount to what I believe the report calls the nation's largest unreported special interest campaign. Almost every area of public policy is affected. So they save on some of the expenses or some of the reporting that has to be done with other campaign contributions, and they contribute pieces of legislation, and they kind of hide in the background while this stuff is pushed through various legislatures.
The initial counting that we did found more than 10,000 bills in state houses over 8 years that were pretty much copies, and that's probably most likely an undercount. We're continuing to examine ongoing, you know, the 2019 session and in different ways using some different tools at our disposal and looking at matches across the states.
It's a huge chunk of algorithms to figure out whether this stuff is moving around the country.
Yeah, and that's what's cool about our partnership with USA Today is they were approaching it from one way of looking at it, of trying to find model legislation and all these state bills, and we are we approached it from a different way, and then we kind of combined forces and I think had a stronger analysis because of that. And our model legislation finder actually will be rolling out soon to help reporters kind of find bills in their states that they may not have known was model legislation. So there's kind of multiple parts to the project, which is I think one of the reasons it's so cool and such a boon to journalism.
And how much cut and paste are we talking about here? In other words, if you saw that there were bills that were virtually the same going from Arizona to Nebraska to Georgia, whatever, could you tell that virtually in all of the language was taken directly from wherever it was sourced?
Oh, definitely. I mean, depending on the subject area, yeah, some of it was word for word. Other times it was just the kind of keywords of what was actually changing in the law were scraped from somewhere else. The story that I focused on earlier this year, which was looking at how states were legislating against boycotts of Israel, in one case it was clear, this didn't go through the legislature, but the executive order was word for word written from what the model that the lobbyist had passed on to the governor's office. I mean, it was barely tweaked at all. It was very similar to language in other states. So yeah, that's not surprising to see states pass identical language. And I think, to be honest, and many of the states where they're smaller legislatures, they don't have a lot of staff. I mean, it makes a lot of sense for lawmakers to be looking for a version that's already written somewhere. So they end up picking that up.
Some of this material ultimately rises to become federal legislation. We'll talk about one of those bills, Right to Try, as we move along. But what percentage of these sign-on bills become law? Is it 20%?
That is a great question. I know there have been more than 2,100 of the bills in the last 8 years that have been signed into law, and again, that's probably an undercount. And there's a lot more that just get introduced because I think it makes the lawmaker look productive to have a few bills that they introduced that they got from somewhere else. But yeah, it does end up affecting public policy. I mean, these bills go a long way.
And often reading the report says that inexperienced legislators seem very open to glomming on to ready-made bills. And as you say, look, they like to look like they're busy. I mean, I see that in our state legislature, and they're throwing bills into the hopper at the beginning of the session at a rate that is extraordinary. Many of them don't get through the committee process in my state, but nonetheless, they can send out news releases, newsletters, look what I'm doing. And oftentimes, of course, this is the other really interesting piece, the legislation, whatever the title of it is oftentimes the opposite of what the intent of the bill is.
There's so little scrutiny in so many of these state houses. I mean, the press corps in so many states has just been decimated by job losses, and you know, things can really go haywire and people not notice. And so I think that's part of the story here, is there's just no one to pay attention to whether your transparency bill actually hides things. But, and then in addition, you know, there are lobbyists who are working on national level issues and hope to get a, you know, a bill through Congress. And one of the ways that they, a good way to kind of show, you know, Congress that this has broad national support is for them to be able to say, oh, well, you know, 10 states have already considered doing this and 5 of them passed it. And, you know, it'd just be way easier if we just did it at the federal level. So that sometimes is, you know, they're laying the groundwork at the state level to then do a national campaign.
And that makes a lot of sense. Now, one of the progenitors of the fill-in-the-blank legislation is a group called ALEC. And there's also the Goldwater Institute. But, you know, the Heart Association gets involved. There are many groups that do this, but there are some that do it with a vengeance. This group, ALEC, can you describe who they are, what they do? I mean, they hold conferences and all. So, in a sense, this isn't that secretive a process.
Yeah, the American Legislative Exchange Council is a conservative organization, and they have probably been the most successful group at doing this, and they have gotten more transparent over the years in terms of what they tell people they're doing. They publish, you know, many of their model bills online. You can go look at them on their website. There is a liberal counterpart to ALEC, sometimes called ALICE, that's been taken over by a group called the State Innovation Exchange. It tries to do the same thing. Thus far has not been as successful, of course. Republicans currently dominate state legislatures, so that makes a lot of sense. But ALEC has meetings every year in which it has corporate sponsors present, and there's, you know, not a lot of clarity on where all the influence is coming from and how much of a voice those corporate sponsors get, and all these little committees where they have state legislatures kind of voting on what model legislation they'll do. But definitely you can see some of the links between folks who have sponsored their conferences or their organization in the past and some of what they're supporting. And some of it doesn't even ideologically necessarily align, I would say. I mean, it's, there are some things that they support that kind of contradict each other, I've found in a couple cases. But by and large, they're very successful. And, you know, a legislator who has conservative credentials and has conservative voters can very easily pick up a piece of their legislation and say, we know this aligns with our values because ALEC has put it out there and endorsed it and written it and all that kind of thing.
Is this an extension? You know, we often hear about campaign financing, campaign finance reform. So if somebody funds a campaign, are they more likely then to be able to go to a legislator after and say, by the way, I've been very supportive of you, I'd like you to look at this piece of legislation? And they may be a local person who's gotten it from ALEC or from some other organization, or they might be part of that national group. Is this an extension of the debate about campaign finance?
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, I'm sure that scenario happens many, many times over the course of the year in state legislatures. You know, whether campaign finance influences decision-making in the policy world is a very hotly debated topic, and there's a lot of research on both sides. But one of the things that has the strongest piece of evidence when you look at the political science behind that is that it does increase access. And so maybe, you know, the legislature doesn't do everything that a lobbyist who has donated to them wants, but they will definitely give them a meeting. Yeah, that's the time then a model piece of bill, a model legislation would get passed or handed over to a legislator and say, you know, this is something that's ready to go and you can introduce it
and be a hero.
Maybe we have a coalition behind it already or something like that. So yeah, I think that's definitely part of the story.
Absolutely. Liz White, a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, is with us on the line on America Trends. Let me ask you about this. This seems to make sense to me. I've done some work on occupational licensing on a previous podcast, and it varies so much state to state. So it would seem that if there were more uniformity, many states abut one another. And so if I can practice in New York State, but I can't practice in Massachusetts or Connecticut, and I'm living right on the border, it does make sense to go and try to influence a number of those legislatures to make this more uniform so that I can be an interior decorator or a tattoo artist or whatever it may be. Is that part of what we're talking about here, or not really a big part of it?
Oh, that's definitely part. I mean, I would say there's, on that particular issue, there's model legislation on both sides, right? So there's groups like the Council of State Governments who are trying to do those uniform laws where every state just makes it easy for, you know, folks who are in the military or just everybody to not have to need a different state license whenever they move to work those jobs. But then there's also the groups like the beauty associations or the pick a career in an association, that yes, the dental hygienist, you know, who works on Tuesdays association or whatever it is, who go in with their specific thing that they would like each state to pass in terms of you need to be licensed in this specific way. And there's a good model bill that has gotten a lot of traction in states about, you know, how you have to be licensed to be an elevator repairman and different things. And some of those have good, you know, backings on them. I mean, you kind of want people to know what they're doing in some cases, but in other cases, the occupational licensing gets very detailed and prevents people from getting into the workforce. Yeah, so there's two sides to every coin, but on this, there's model legislation on both. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that. Because we have some in my state, like interior decorators. I mean, if they don't do a good job, I don't think anybody dies. But there are other professions where you really want them to have some credential. Now, these model bills, they seem to make more sense, they say, because corporations and special interests have the time to study the impact of a proposed bill. So that's the way that certain people rationalize why they take them. It's not because I'm lazy or it's not because I'm in their pocket, but it's because they have the time and they've studied this issue. And we often hear that even about lobbyists, that in a state, and I live in one that seems to be progressive, but they love to hear from lobbyists because they say, you know, they give me great information.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, and definitely there's a dearth of expertise on some of these issues in many states. There's a lack of professional staff and some of these small state legislatures to even vet ideas on whether they're good ones. So, you know, model legislation can be a helpful shortcut for legislators. At the same time, it's, you know, you just have to wonder, well, what other ideas aren't getting considered because there wasn't a well-funded interest group to support it, or, you know, are there other policy ideas that would have worked better in this particular state that if they just hadn't just copied the California and Colorado and New York bills or whatever it is, would have suited that state better. I mean, the whole point of our system and the United States of America is that the states kind of can innovate and be laboratories for different policies, and that's not really happening if everyone's just adopting the same thing that was pushed by a well-funded interest group.
Is there much denial from legislators as to the origin of these bills? Because there was one case, reading your report, where a gentleman took one state legislator, 72 bills, without knowing the origin.
Denial and also just ignorance. You know, they may not have known that a lobbyist was coming to them with a bill that was originally from ALEC or vice, you know, other groups like that. You know, there's a lot of these legislatures are part-time, and a lot of demands are made upon them, and, you know, it's easier than you think to not know where this bill is coming from as a legislator.
So you say it landed on my desk somehow. I thought it was a really good idea, so I put it in. So I guess there is plausible deniability. The issue of title deception is certainly a part of your story. The HOPE Act, which makes it harder to get food stamps. Now, when you hear HOPE, you would not imagine that that's really what the act is all about. So is that often the case with these pieces of legislation?
Yeah, I don't know that it's the case in the majority of them, but definitely a lot of them get tricky with their acronyms and language, or they're dealing with a very technical aspect of legislation that maybe a subcommittee would be familiar with, but most lawmakers would not. And so it's very unclear what the legislation even does. The HOPE Act, in particular, it's a group that has gone around to different states advocating for welfare reform and trying to get people off food stamps and off Medicaid and different things like that. And yes, it was entitled the HOPE Act, but really it was encouraging people to not take government benefits.
Well, there's another one called Right to Try, and I know a little bit about this because we did a podcast with the same person that you quoted from NYU, and it gave the sense that all these experimental drugs were going to rush into the marketplace, and the president, President Trump, announced it saying, this is going to save thousands and thousands of lives, and it sounded so good. Right to try. So let's, you know, just experiment a little bit. When in fact the FDA process allows a lot of this to go on in a way, or maybe it's NIH, but it allows a lot of this testing to go on. They do have a process for it. This legislation was really meant, I think, for the Cancer Centers of America. And at the time that you wrote this piece, it said only two people in the country had availed themselves of the content of the bill.
Yeah, Right to Try, it was a very successful state model legislation campaign. And the name itself was, as you mentioned, focus tested early on by a group that, you know, was tangential to people's understanding of the issue. Cancer Treatment Centers of America is a chain focused on alternative cancer treatments, but it took off thanks to the Goldwater Institute and ended up, you know, on the federal landscape, and it having been debated in many, many states previous to that. And like I said, it was a great example of legislation, model legislation getting passed from state to state, and then there being kind of momentum and the federal government saying, well, if all these states are doing it, maybe we should do it too.
Exactly. One of the things that your report said is that model bills at times actually work against local interests. In other words, they're coming from somewhere else. There's no real groundswell within the state necessarily for what is being offered, and it may run counter to public opinion in various states.
So, for example, with the anti-Israel boycott legislation, you know, that was introduced by specific pro-Israel interest groups in many states, and they were able to mobilize people with really firm opinions on how states should not do business with companies that boycott Israel. But there are lots of people in those states who believed the opposite. They just weren't, you know, mobilized in that same way, didn't have their own piece of model legislation. And so you wound up with a very kind of lopsided conversation in many of these state legislatures. These bills passed with overwhelming majorities because the side with the kind of organized model legislation campaign had already done so much groundwork that it just seemed like a no-brainer. And now they're being challenged in all kinds of court cases and that kind of thing, as unconstitutional, but the pro BDS side or boycott of Israel side was just really slow to kind of court to respond in the legislature when these bills were being debated, and so now there's a little bit more back and forth in the courtroom, but at the time it was just so quick for many of these places.
Well, it also happens seemingly on these other issues that are really on the ground in various communities and sometimes overrides local voters, elected leaders. I guess in a couple of states, increasing the minimum wage, there was some model legislation to keep that from happening, even though if you polled the people in the state, they wanted to see that, or banning plastic bags or whatever. So they're not afraid to get on the ground, many of these national organizations, and try to impose their will, even if public sentiment seems to be running against them. How much effort do they put behind these when they know that there's a legislator who has some influence or a committee within a legislature that is looking at one of these model pieces of legislation? Does an Alice or an Alec or any of these organizations or the conglomeration of insurance companies, which you folks point out, oftentimes they get together under some banner, some of the biggest insurance companies, do they then go in and put muscle and money into those states to try to push this through?
Oh, definitely. These are organized campaigns that include several parts. We think of the used car dealers who got together, wrote some model legislation that would allow them to keep selling recalled cars as long as they kind of disclosed it in somewhat a sneaky way. And then they kind of beefed up their army of lobbyists and got more than 600 on the payroll in all kinds of states, 43 states. And one at a time, these measures start passing. And that's pretty typical of a lot of these campaigns of, you know, start with maybe some of the friendlier states, easier states, build the momentum and see it snowball.
I'm wondering how much of this is termed tort reform. I say this because I went to a conference just a week ago that Ralph Nader held because he's got a tort museum in my state of Connecticut. And it was fascinating. He was saying that whenever you do see something that is labeled tort reform, people think that's good. What that usually means is if you have a grievance against a company or a service or an institution, your right to go as a class or individually and sue them is going to be more limited over time. In your report, it does suggest that a number of the measures we're talking about, though a broad range of bills are included in this model legislation, but a lot of them do deal with things called tort reform.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the kind of less understood aspects of these bills is that it can seem to a legislature that it's like, oh, this is a bill that's good for building up this industry. It's business friendly in our state, but you know, not really thinking about any long term consequences for other places. I mean, it goes both ways on the tort reform, though, too. The USA Today reporter just had a great story out ongoing in the project about how there was some model legislation that was actually trying to extend the amount of time that child sexual abuse survivors, particularly those with a story involving the Catholic Church, would be able to sue, and how the Boy Scouts and Catholic Church and some other groups kind of ramped up their lobbying campaign against that series of legislation that was all very similar and could be termed model legislation. Yeah, I think it goes both ways, but definitely it seems like things that aren't easily understood do really well as model legislation.
And you do say in the report that progressive groups are not as good at this as conservative ones. And we've done a lot of reporting on how the conservative agenda has been pushed along with real intent for many years, using think tanks and a whole range of devices, that they've been much more organized than the more progressive causes. Is that what you have found in your reporting?
Just looking at the numbers, you know, in our, like I said, in that initial count of 10,000 model bills, yeah, there have been, you know, 4,000 that you could probably term, you know, very easily conservative bills versus only 1,600 that were liberal. But definitely both sides use this tactic. And, you know, one of the things we examined in one of our stories is how both sides of the abortion debate, you know, push similar bills in several states in order to get all the red states to do one thing and all the blue states to do another thing, and has really led to kind of some of the extreme polarization in abortion policy in America.
Do you think that people should use this question about copycat legislation or model bills or fill-in-the-blank legislation, should they ask their legislator when it's coming up for reelection, and I know most legislatures are in 2020, should they say to them, look, are you prone to just take stuff simply because it may align with you, or how much do you think about it? How much original thought do you put into the legislation that you put forward? Is that something we should be asking our legislators about?
I think any questions that citizens want to poke and prod legislators on are good ones. I just think a lot of these state houses don't get enough scrutiny and on a whole range of issues. And so, yeah, if you can clearly articulate your policies of governance and how this, you know, piece of model legislation fits really well into it, you know, bravo for you, state legislator. But I think a lot of them just aren't really paying attention to where it's coming from, and, you know, maybe a bit thoughtless about what their constituents would really need in respect to certain policies.
Well, Liz, I think people listening to this might say to themselves, I really want to read this report. I want to see all the work that's being done because I didn't know anything about model legislation. How can they best do that? Through the center's website, USA Today, because there's been this ongoing flood of great information. So how can we best access it?
But if you want to just Google Center for Public Integrity and then copy, paste, legislate is the name of the project, it'll come up, and we've got a dozen plus stories on this issue there on our website. You can also just go to publicintegrity.org and look at our menu in the top right, and then scroll down, and you'll see copy paste legislate, and it links to all of the stories we've done over the past year, and including the USA Today one, and has a great kind of overview too. If you go to the second page, there's a little video about how model bills work, which I think is a great educational tool for folks just to get the basics of this or to share it with friends or family who don't know anything about the issue. And then if we've written so many different stories about this, you know, feel free to share. And there's stuff on tobacco and vaping and Israel and abortion and pretty much everything. These bills have run the gamut, so.
Yeah, it's great material. And so if you're a teacher out there or you know a teacher, maybe this is the new way that a bill becomes a law. And you may want to share this with your students. And again, I think you've opened some eyes today. I really do. Liz White, a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, thank you so much for being part of America Trends.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.